can I consider myself any better than any other fan anywhere around the world? Absolutely not. And it's been part of what we've done is to try and make the community as inclusive as possible for people who will never get to London, who will never, ever get to see Arsenal play at the Emirates Stadium or anywhere else.
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name is Owen Connolly. Hope you're well. Hello to you if you're here for the first time. Do make yourself comfortable. Hello again if you're a repeat listener. It's great to have you back. Now, depending on your affiliations, the next voice you hear could either be incredibly familiar or very much not so. That's because Andrew Mangan is the founder of Arseblog, the Arsenal network that is one of the most popular and enduring fan-led media companies in football. Since beginning life as a side project a little over 20 years ago, Arseblog has gathered a daily audience of thousands upon thousands of Gunners around the world. It's spawned a news service, two weekly podcasts, regular live events and subscriber bonuses, bringing fans together not just through their support for a North London football club, but also a bit of wry humour, community, and a sense of shared experience. It's far from the only fan media outlet to have achieved that, of course. It's just the one that I happen to have spent a disturbingly large chunk of my own time consuming. So it's a good way into a much wider conversation. I spoke to Andrew not just about the Arseblog journey and its particular perspective and ad-free business model, but also the impact of fan media on football culture, the possibilities it's opened up for far deeper coverage, and the implications of all that for traditional media organisations. We discuss the importance of authenticity and consistency in the space, and how the global reach of these outlets has helped change perceptions of fandom altogether. There's hopefully something here, even for non-Arsenal supporters. I've done my best with that, but, you know. Either way, if you've been enjoying the podcast so far, then I'd love it if you could take the time to subscribe, rate and review, share links and recommend it to your friends and rivals. The social media details are in the show notes, so do check those out too. But whoever you follow, this was a great chat. Here is Andrew Mangan. New season. You've just got back from Singapore. How much does your stuff just sort of roll from the old season into the summer, into the new season? How much do you sort of stop and retool and rethink things?
Not at all, really. There used to be a bit of demarcation with the podcast. When the podcast first started, which was back in 2006, it used to take the summer off, you know? Because there wasn't really a... Well, it wasn't that there wasn't stuff, but there wasn't the same demand that there is now. It has become, and podcasts have become such a sort of cornerstone of people's lives that even if there's not much going on, you still need to give them something to listen to. So it is different from the way it used to be back in, the earlier 2000s and even the early 2010s. But yeah, there just seems to be so much going on now. The media landscape is such that there is no downtime whatsoever, you know? So it is what it is. You roll with how things change over the years. And that's certainly one of the things that's different.
Yeah. Is that something you see reflected in the numbers at all? Is it now fairly consistent, like just quite ritualized?
I don't look at numbers. Never. Genuinely.
Yeah.
Never do. Yeah. I've never been driven by analytics. I feel like you can go down a wrong path.
Sure.
If you're trying to... Look, it probably works for some people. They analyze what went well or what happened in an episode or something, and why did that one draw more numbers or get more downloads or more listens or whatever it might be. But I always feel if you start tailoring your content towards numbers, you're not focusing on the content. You're focusing on the numbers. Whether it's page views or downloads or listens, I don't look. You know, we're in a very privileged position now at Arseblog in that we don't have to really furnish that information to anyone. We don't have any advertisers on the site. So there's no, well, how many page views are you getting? How many unique visitors are you getting? How many, where are they? How old are they? All that kind of stuff, you know, to tailor advertising campaigns and those kinds of things. So we don't have to worry about them. All we have to focus on is making the best content that we can make. And work on the assumption that if you do that, there's always going to be people out there who want to read it or listen to it.
Yeah. So do you have a kind of any kind of feedback loop at all? Do you, because I mean, we're going to get on to talk about how sort of the scope of an outlet like Ask Blogs change when you introduce stuff like Patreon and Discord and all that sort of stuff. And it becomes a really kind of community rooted thing. But like, do you work on, you know, you have conversations internally and you think, well, this works, this doesn't work, or we want to talk about this, or we want to cover this, or do you kind of feedback from the community? Where do you get a sense of what's working and what's not?
I don't. Maybe is the right way to put it. I don't, I'm not strategic. I'm not sure. A strategy guy at all. So I will try things, and if they work, then I'll know if they work because people like them and enjoy them. Or if they don't work, you know, you get that feedback from people who use the site, from the communities. You know, there are sort of various communities within Arsblog itself. You know, it's not just, it is one thing, but then there's people who only comment on the main blog. There's people who only comment on Arsblog News. There's people who will do both. There's people who are Patreon members. There's people who are Patreon members and Discord members, but some of them aren't Discord, you know. So you get a sense of what works and whether it fits. You know, I think having done this for so long, you kind of understand organically what is right for the audience and what is going to work and what won't work, or what I'm not good at or what I'm not comfortable with. But as I said to you, I feel like it's very much gut instinct stuff, you know? But if you are looking to, Arsblog is a business, but it's not really business orientated. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I'm not a business guy. I'm like a writer and a broadcaster, a podcaster. I like to create things, and I'm very, very fortunate that what I've created has garnered an audience, which allows me to run a business, which is, you know, pretty successful. But I, you know, the numbers and all of that stuff leaves me very, very cold. So I focus primarily on ensuring that what we do is the best possible quality for people.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's my thing. It's not about quantity. Even when we did had advertising on the site, we could have done things way differently. We could have generated a lot more revenue from advertising, but we deliberately chose A, not to sort of push out a lot of crappy content just because we wanted page views, and B, we made sure that the advertising we ran on the site was as inobtrusive as possible. So never ever did any auto-playing videos or pop-ups or pop-unders. And you know what it's like when you go visit a site now and you have to scroll and then you're like clicking this thing. Anything that impeded the content was sort of anathema to us. So it was always about quality rather than quantity, and that remains the case.
Yeah, yeah. So what's your view then that you take on the summer, because there's a natural cadence, particularly when you're doing, as you do, sort of post-match stuff and pre-match stuff. There's a natural cadence through the season, and I know you've changed your publishing schedule a little in the last couple of years to kind of more closely align with, you know, what competitions the club might be in or what have you.
Sure.
Do you just sort of follow the news cycle in the summer? Do you have things that you want to get through or get to when there isn't that sort of that framework in place for you?
It's kind of reactive, isn't it? Because you're dependent on stories and information. And we're not necessarily what you would call I don't want to do anybody down, but we're not like a journalistic outlet in that we're not digging for stories. We sometimes get stories and we'll happily publish those, but we're not sort of doing the meat and drink work that many of the journalists out there are doing. to varying degrees of quality and success, of course. But if there's nothing going on, you know, the blog is a different thing on its own. The blog is its own thing. So there's always something on the blog every day. News is a different thing. If there is no news, we don't publish any news. It's as simple as that. Like someone asked me the other day, it was like earlier in the summer, and they said, is the app broken? Because the news hasn't updated in 3 days. I said, no, it's not broken. There just hasn't been anything worth writing about for 3 days.
Yeah.
So it's very much a case of going with the flow and seeing what happens and reporting or sort of taking on board the reports that are out there and presenting those to our audience in the way that we do them. But we don't sit down and say, right, in June, we've got to write 500 news stories.
Yeah.
Because what are you going to write about? You know, you end up creating nothing, drama out of nothing, you know? And there's enough of that out there.
Yeah, for sure.
Anyway, so we don't want to contribute to that.
What's your, you were really quite early, I think you would say, to blogging. You got to that, you know, at a good inflection point to find the audience that you did find. And probably you could say quite similar to podcasting. It had been around, but you know, the point that you started your podcast and then you added the one with James McNicholas a little later on was at a point where people were gravitating towards them, but not where everyone and their dog and, you know, me had their own podcasts getting underway.
Yeah.
You know, but what's your approach been to that? Has that been a similarly kind of experimental thing? You're interested in it sort of creatively, you think we could have a go at this, or something that you'd maybe seen in other parts of your interactions with the media? How did you gravitate towards stuff like that?
Well, I mean, I think I've been really lucky, you know. I will say that from the off, like, it's not to sort of say I don't put the work in, but I think timing wise I have been quite fortunate. I've told the story before and I don't want to go into the whole Arsblog origin story again, but originally the site was set up as a way for me to practice web design back in 2002, because I had a small little web design, web hosting business with a friend of mine, and the idea of having a website that I could constantly update as a way of learning and developing web design skills was essentially, that's why it started. But I'm not very good at web designing, and I've always liked writing. So it was a case that at that time blogs were becoming a thing. Not too many sports blogs; they tended to be techie or lifestyle-y or that kind of stuff. So I think I was probably one of the first football blogs, if not the first football blog. So that's quite fortuitous. You know, just a question of timing. And it became clear to me that my aptitude lay far more in writing than it did in design. So that's kind of how it started and how it developed. Similarly, when podcasts started becoming not a thing, because I think it took quite a number of years for podcasts to really, really, really become mainstream. You know, for years, people would say, you know, what's a blog? And for years, people would say, what's a podcast? Everyone knows what they are now, but it did take time. But I had a background in radio, in radio production. I knew how to do it, you know? I knew how to edit audio. I knew how to set up a microphone. I knew how to talk into a microphone. So again, that was 2006.
Yeah.
So timing-wise, just sort of doing it, thinking this might be a good idea, I'll give this a try, has worked out really well for me. So it's I think sort of being one of the first at something gives you a foundation or a platform maybe that adds a bit of, I don't know whether gravitas is the right word, or authority to the platform. Ultimately, it comes down to what you're producing as well. You can be first and you can talk a lot of crap and write a load of nonsense and people won't listen or they won't read. So there is that other side of it. But I think sort of being there first as one of the foundational, I think Arscast was the very first club-specific football podcast.
Mm.
So you're around and people are just sort of aware of you, and that gives you sort of not a voice of authority, but people understand that this isn't like a fly-by-night kind of thing.
Yeah, on that point, I mean, how early, one of the things that's kind of the whole context of this conversation is, if you are an Arsenal fan, there's a very strong chance that you've consumed Arsblog stuff in the last 20 years.
Mm.
If you're not, you might have no idea who you are or why we're having this conversation, but this is my frame of reference for,
sure,
the kind of fan media. But something that people who are aware of you will be very aware of you is you're just staggeringly consistent. That blog has gone up almost every single day since it started. The same is true of the podcast and of the extra. You know, there's you miss like what, 1 or 2 weeks a year, I think, on both. How early did you come to the conclusion that that sort of consistency was important as well?
I mean, I think with the blog, what was quite interesting was it used to be quite ad hoc. I was living in Spain at the time when I started, and it was quite ad hoc. I'd post whenever. And then I got a job. I was living in a town outside of Barcelona. I got a job in Barcelona. So I had to get the train from this town into Barcelona every day, do my work, come home on the train. Fine. But what that did was make me post the blog first thing in the morning. And it was also, again, this is like a weird question of good timing. It was around the time that high-speed internet started to become prevalent in people's houses and in people's work in particular, right? So more and more people were online. And what happened was, because of the hour difference, let's say, between Spain and the UK, which is where, you know, the biggest market for Arsblog is, and certainly was back then, people would get up in the morning or they would get to work, and the first thing they would do is open up Arsblog and have a read and see what the blog was every day. So it became like a morning paper for people. You know, people would like send me emails and say, listen, you know, the first thing I do every morning is I make a coffee, I sit in the toilet and I read Arsblog. And that's a compliment, you know? So it was that sort of consistency of schedule made a real difference. I noticed that really quickly, that when the blog wasn't posted on time, people would be like, where's the blog? What's happening here? Why isn't it up yet? You know? And so that, I think, became pretty much a cornerstone of everything we've done since. You know, it remains true of the blog. It's up pretty much first thing every morning for people, you know, 8 o'clock, 7:30 in the morning, Irish time, UK time, it's there. And people have become used to that. And I think that's a really important thing. People used to email me a lot, you know, when blogs were really, really fashionable. There used to be a lot of Arsenal blogs, a lot of football blogs as well. And people would email me for advice and say, what advice would you give me if I want to set up my blog? And among the pieces of advice I would give would be consistent.
Mm.
Like if you are giving people something at 9 o'clock every day of the week, make sure it's there every day of the week. If you're doing it even 3-4 days a week, make a consistent schedule so people understand, you know, when it is that content is going to be available to them, rather than sort of refreshing, people get frustrated, you know? So if you had your Arsenal blog and you were posting every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and you were doing it at 10 o'clock, but sometimes it was 3, or sometimes it was 5, or sometimes it was 1, whatever it is, you're going to lose people.
Yeah.
Because they want it there at 10 o'clock. You know, if it's there at 10, but then, so that's, yeah, that has been a really big thing. You know, it's a daily edition. And that means when I'm not around, if I'm not around, you know, I get other people to write the blog. I'm very fortunate. We've got some really good writers who understand Arsblog and understand the tone and understand what it is that we do and how we do it. So I'm very fortunate in that regard to have people who can fill in for me. But again, when they do it, it's that schedule. It works to that schedule. And that has been, you know, at the heart of everything we've done since 2002.
Yeah. And it's interesting that it's, you know, there's the ritualized nature of being a fan anyway, when it comes to the things that you do before a game, the things that you do over the course of a week as a game's coming up or what have you. But also, like, as media environments got more competitive and there's more competition for your attention, like, it's harder to get into the shuffle, right? So being, I suppose, in that position early on means that whatever else is out there has to displace what you're doing in somebody's day, you know, before they get to it.
Yeah, there's a lot of choice out there now, and there's a lot of ways to consume content in a way that there wasn't, you know, 20 years ago. 20 years ago, you could write something and people could read it, and that was more or less it. And then you had podcasts that came along and you could listen to it. And then you had social media that came along, and for better or worse, and quite often worse, you know, you could connect. I think there was a sort of golden age, really, of social media, which was very, very important for Arsblog and very important for the community, you know, in that it allowed you direct contact with people who, let's say, didn't want to comment on a blog or didn't want to comment on a news piece, but were happy to engage on social media and to have chats and to, you know, to have a bit of crack and everything else. And then you had video that came along and people could watch what you were doing. And yeah, I mean, that's just the way the landscape develops over time. You have to be, I guess, a little bit fluid while also recognizing where your strengths are, what you're comfortable doing, what you think your audience wants as well. So we don't do a lot of video. We have a YouTube channel and there's some stuff on there, and we put the podcast up, but it's with a sort of rotating animation. We don't do video on the podcasts. And I'm quite happy with that. Some people are like, why can't I see you when you're talking? And I go, why would you want to see me when I'm talking? What is the benefit to you of seeing, you know, me in my studio doodling away while someone else is talking? You know, to me, that's not where I'm comfortable. So I kind of leave that for other people. And I'm always cognizant of the fact that there is something for everybody out there to every degree, good, bad, indifferent, whatever your poison, it's out there for you on the internet, you know, and you can't please all of the people all of the time. So you have to recognize, you know, who your audience is and what kind of people you think they are, you know? And that in turn then informs the way that you talk and the way that you write and the way that you speak, because you know fundamentally at the core of it, that's what that audience is.
Yeah, I was going to pick up on the video point, because that is something that lots of people in the podcast space have not just been doing, but been saying has been very valuable to them for discovery and things like that. But, you know, you've addressed it, but you've done it in a different way from other people. Does that just come back to the point you were making earlier, that a lot of the stuff you've done has been rooted in things that you understood and things that you felt you had a mastery of or an interest in outside of this project?
There's a quality issue for me as well.
Mm-hmm.
In that, generally speaking, when I'm... The two podcasts are quite distinct, right? So the Arscast and the Arscast Extra are distinct in that they're put together differently. When we do the Arscast Extra, it's me and James, and it's very much like this. We connect. We have a conversation for about 90 minutes. We don't really use video. Very rarely use video. We did it yesterday, actually, as a bit of an experiment. And I find it, because, I don't know, I just find it strange, because we've always done it with just audio. Mm-hmm. And I think it works really well for both of us in that regard. But there's generally something in a podcast when I'm recording that I want to go back and slightly edit. And I'm not talking about editing chunks of what we say, or thinking, oh, I wish we hadn't said it that way, I'll go back and re-record a bit. It's small things, which for me have an impact on the sound quality. So it might be a cough, it might be a sniffle, it might be a little weird when you're talking, you know, that I will make a note of and go back and edit, because I feel like that is going to ensure that the audio quality, the audio content I put out, is the highest possible quality. Where I struggle with video in that sense then is, you know, it's really easy to edit audio. It's not as easy to edit video in the same way.
Hmm.
So I feel like the workflow, even though we have somebody who does our YouTube channel, the workflow would just be too big for me. Like, it's doable. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I feel like it's just not worth anybody's time.
Hmm.
So it's really just about that, you know, it is about making sure that what I put out is the best quality. And I don't know. I just don't know why anybody would want to watch me anyway, you know? Honestly, I know people do it and I know people have got very accustomed to it, but I never feel 100% comfortable with a camera on and recording on video.
Yeah.
It's not to say I'm sort of horrified by my own appearance or anything like that. I just, it's, I don't know. I'm not 100% comfortable with it. And I think that then translates into, if you're conscious of something, right? I think it has an impact on how you perform, if that's the right way of putting it. I'm not saying a podcast is a performance, right? But if you're slightly distracted by one thing, does it then have an impact on what you say, the questions you ask, you know, ultimately what you put out? And for me, it would. And that's why I don't do it.
Yeah. What you have lent into really significantly in the last sort of 5 years or so is that community element. And you know, Where Arse Blog is a business, it's basically a community business. It's Patreon, it's live events, it's things of that nature. You know, is that something that's happened organically, or has there been, you talked about wanting the experience to be as good as possible. Has there been a little bit more intention behind that particular shift?
There was always community when I first started the blog, there were no comments on it because we weren't using any blogging software. So one of the readers of the blog, Tom, who's our tech guy, basically, we had a little sort of plug and play comment thing. We used to just do a HTML page. We put it in. That service fell by the wayside. Tom, who was one of the readers, built our comment system, which is known as the Arses. Yeah, I know. But, you know, they remain in place to this day, right? And Tom, as part of the community, was a big part of that. And then there were like generations of communities that have grown through the site, you know? So there is a forum, like an old school forum where people have been members for over 20 years on that. People have been members on the Arses for a long time, and people come and go, and those communities develop and change, and you know, some people will fall by the wayside, some new faces will come along and they become part of it. So like I said, that there are communities within the community, right?
Mm.
But where I suppose you're going with this is the idea that we are, as a website, it is a community funded or a member supported business. And when I launched the Patreon, it was like, okay, well, let's see what we can do with this. What will Patreon bring? What can we bring to our Patreon members? And how can that have a positive impact on the website? And primarily, it has allowed us to ensure, well, we've no ads at all on the website, as I said. So it's a clean, really clean, easy to read website. No ads anywhere. No ads on the content, below, above, anywhere. So that's, I don't know if it's something people take for granted now, or if they even notice, but that is one of the big benefits of what Patreon has allowed us to do, is to make the website and make our websites and our apps better for everybody, because we don't have to have any advertising on them. And so the community is benefiting from that. It's a circular thing. Obviously, we benefit. We have members and our subscriptions, and that helps us invest more in the website, you know, put some more resources into different aspects of the club and also do things that we weren't previously able to do, but the community also benefits as well, you know? So that's where it becomes kind of circular for me, is like, how do you give people the best possible return for their $5 a month or whatever it is that they're paying on Patreon? $6, so it works out about £5, €5, 50, whatever the exchange rates are now these days. I don't quite know, but it is that. So you obviously want to ensure that everybody has the best possible experience. And the reality is that people who don't or aren't Patreon members also benefit.
Mm-hmm.
they get the benefit of that as well. The Patreon members benefit from a separate community, a slightly different community. They get extra content. They get some benefits in terms of, you know, first access to tickets for live events and things like that. But the wider community benefits as well. Because if the website is better for everyone, then, you know, everyone wins.
Yeah. What's when do you strike a balance between what the free to use part of your offer is and what the community subscription offer is, basically? Did you start by saying, I would like the blog and the podcast to be free, and then everything else we do on that, on top of that, will kind of work either with stuff we're interested in or stuff that we hear people talking about on the Discords and in the arses?
Yeah.
Where did you come up with a solution for that?
What I thought was really, really important was to ensure that whatever people have been getting for free for years and years and years would remain free.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the blog, the arses, Arseblog News, which is our news site, the podcasts, which were always free to air. So all of the stuff that was free was going to stay that way. It never made sense to me to say, right, we're going on Patreon, and if you want to read the blog, you're going to have to pay. Because I think the vast majority of people would have said, good luck to you. You know, I know we live for a long time in a world where there was an expectation of everything on the internet being free, right? Which is, you know, maybe still out there to some extent. But it never made sense to me to say, right, we could get 10 or 15% of our audience paying for the blog, but then your other 85%, where are they going to go? They'll just go somewhere else. You know, Arseblog is not that important that everyone is going to pay for it, right? So it never made sense to me to restrict the audience that we'd spent a long time building and cultivating and sort of, I think, ultimately doing damage to the communities that we've talked about, right? Because you would. So it was all about, there were two aspects of it. One was, if you like what we've been doing on Arseblog for all these years for free and you feel like it's worth something to you, join the Patreon. The other aspect was you get extra if you join the Patreon. So extra written content, extra podcasts, the Discord, those other sort of benefits that we talked about. So the motivation, I suppose, for some people would be, yeah, I want more. I like what Arseblog does. I want more. And by paying $5 a month, you get more. For other people, it was like, I like what Arseblog does. I don't need any more, but I'm happy to support what they do. Because I've been reading it for free for 15, 20 years. Mm. And quite a lot of our original Patreon subscribers were people like that, who are like, I don't have time for any more. I work, I'm married, I've got kids, I just don't have time for any more podcasts, but I like what you do and thank you for doing it for free for so many years. Here's a $5 a month. So that, I think, was really critical. You know, the idea of restricting or putting a paywall around what we do never made any sense to me.
Yeah. There has been a progression in what you do otherwise as well. Some of it on the Patreon side, some of it on the free side, particularly when it comes to stuff like covering the women's team.
Mm.
And you've brought together a kind of collection of people as much as a team, because some of them have full-time jobs or some of them have, whether that's in football media well, James is a different case because he's also an actor, but, you know, in football media or elsewhere. But what's your approach been, A, to the kind of things that people want to hear about, particularly when it comes to the women's side of the club,
mm-hmm.
and B, to the voices that you want to add and the things that they're able to contribute? Has that been a case of opportunity? You've kind of become aware of someone and struck up a relationship and that's been something you've been able to add to the offer? Or is that been, I'd quite like someone to cover the women's team because it's something that Arsenal are quite front-footed about. And
I mean,
you know, you and Tim had obviously been Tim Stillman. This is, had obviously been following them around for a long time.
I mean, it is more or less, as you say, a bit of a sort of opportunity. Tim was doing a column for the website already. And when we started Arseblog News, you know, I think it was a case that we wanted to do more or thought it would be a good idea to do more around the women's team. And Tim had that knowledge and had that expertise and had that ability and willingness to do it. I don't quite know how it would have gone if I'd had to sort of seek somebody out to do it. Probably, I don't know. I just don't know how I would have done it, to be honest. And with some of the other people who've come on board, you know, Andrew Allen, for example, again, it was a little bit of an opportunity. Andrew was working for a website that went bust, a football sports website that went bust, and I knew he was an Arsenal fan, and we connected, and we've been working together on Arseblog News for like 14 years. James, I knew because of Gunnerblog, and when I thought about having a different podcast or an additional podcast, he was the first person I thought of because we'd done podcasts together. We'd done the Arsecast together quite a bit. And I felt like we had a pretty good connection, a pretty good chemistry. He's a very funny guy. And I always enjoyed the conversations that we had. So it was a case like, oh yeah, well, you know, do you want to do this? And it was, yeah, sure. And then over the years, you sort of get to know people online and you get to understand how they think about football and how they think about Arsenal. Do they fit? Do they work? Can they come on board and offer something? And yeah, they can. You know, people like Lewis Ambrose and Phil Costa as well have really added something to the mix. And that's kind of the way it's happened. It's been pretty organic. I haven't sort of put ads in the paper. You know, we're looking for a reporter, we're looking for a contributor. We get a lot of emails, you know, going, do you need any writers? I'd really like to get on board. And you know, we kind of have to fend off a lot of those kinds of advances because there isn't really room at this moment in time unless we do something extra, something new, something we're not doing at this particular moment that somebody else has an expertise in, then that could be an opportunity for somebody. But I don't quite know what that is at this moment in time in football. I don't know what else we can cover about the club. I don't know what we're not covering, you know? So... yeah, it's been again, I don't want to say fortuitous, but I think maybe it's a question of just being able to spot people who you think are talented. You read some of their stuff or you listen to them on something and you go, yeah, that guy could be a good fit or that girl could be a good fit. Yeah, that's just how it's happened.
Yeah. And is that fairly consistent with, you know, you have a relationship now with another Arsenal fan media group called Arsenal Vision, which is sort of informal but sort of not. You do campaigns together, you do events together. Is that a similar thing, just struck up a relationship and there's a bit of chemistry there?
Tim is part of the Arsenal Vision podcast. The guys, you know, Clive, I've known for a very long time. I remember talking to him about something we did. We went to a meetup, an internet meetup in the late 90s, back when you didn't know if you were, you know, going to come home from one of those things because everyone on the internet was weird and scary, right? So I've known Clive since then. Paul, I knew online. Elliot, I knew online. And you know, always had a good relationship with them and enjoyed their podcast. And sort of I approached Elliot to say, look, we're thinking of doing an end of season podcast, a live event. Do you think you guys want to come on board? And between the two sort of communities, you know, there's quite considerable overlap between our two communities, but we also have our distinct factions is not the right word, but distinct elements, you know. You know, we sell out Union Chapel or Alexandra Palace in, you know, a matter of minutes because the demand is high and the communities are big and enthusiastic and they really want to come along and be part of these live shows. So I'm always open to working with people, collaborating with people. I've always tried as well, you know, when I've been doing the podcast to help promote other people, you know, whether it's journalists or blogs or other podcasts or what have you, you know, to sort of, Arse Blog is a big platform, probably the biggest Arsenal platform outside, you know, certainly from a podcast perspective. I think there's probably, you know, YouTube stuff, which is bigger. AFTV, for example, is just sort of phenomenal in terms of its size because of the medium that it's on and because of the kind of content that they do. But in terms of, you know, writing, podcasting, those kinds of things, it's been a big platform. And so I'm always open to sharing that platform because it might be beneficial to other people.
Yeah. Yeah. How much do you look around at what other fan media businesses do? I mean, you talked about AFTV there, and I think people will understand there's a point of difference in terms of your approach and shall we say the tenor maybe of it. I don't know. I'm trying to be as generous to both of you as I can. It's different media strokes. Yeah. But one thing you do is you involve people from other clubs sometimes, particularly before games or around transfers sometimes or what have you. I mean, do you keep an eye on what some of those are up to or try and get a sense of what works for some other clubs, or does it come back to your kind of ethos where it's, look, we have our community and we talk to them and we work from that basis?
Yeah, I mean, I recognize, for example, AFTV, right? They do something on a completely different media platform than us. They operate, they live on YouTube. And I think within that ecosystem, there is I don't want to say a style, but, you know, there is a sort of demand for people to do things differently. It is a different medium. It demands more of the people because, you know, it's more in your face, for example.
Yeah, different relationship with attention.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And look, this is where I say to each their own, you know, if that's the football media that you want to consume, do it. You know, it's there. It's horses for courses. And, you know, there is one man's meat, et cetera, you know? But I, you know, I don't think, and I guess Robbie would probably say the same, you know, if he was talking about Arse Blog, he'll understand what it is. He knows where it is and what it is we do. Is there anything he can take from Arse Blog? Don't think so. Mm. Similarly, that there isn't really anything I would take from AFTV or any other YouTube channel, right? Unless I wanted to go into that ecosystem or operate more within that ecosystem. If, and I'm not saying this is what I want to do or will do, and I'm almost certain it's not going to be something I would do, but maybe if you were going to go in and do something on YouTube and you look at the big football media outlets, not just AFTV, that operate on YouTube, is there a way you could do it differently? I think there probably is. I think there probably is. Is that what the YouTube audience wants? Not 100% sure on that, you know? So is it worth your time doing it in a different way? I don't want to say, and this is not specific to AFTV or any of the big football media outlets. I'm not saying everyone is a raging lunatic. There are some out there, right? Who the algorithms, if you're angry, if you're getting clipped up, if you're getting shared around, it's good for you because it puts eyeballs on your channel and those kinds of things. There's people out there doing very, very good stuff and very considered content and everything else. It just isn't really what I would do. Mm. I think where I might look around sometimes is just see stylistically what are people doing. Are there ideas out there? I'm not saying you're just looking around and stealing people's ideas, but are there things that people are writing or are there ways in which they're presenting their content, or are there ways, for example, in, you know, that they're maximizing their audience that you might look at and think, oh, that could be a good idea. Like we tried, for example, for a couple of days to provide a sort of a listen option on the website where, I guess, for want of a better word, an AI voice would read the blog to people. Like it provides them with an audio offering. But I wasn't really comfortable with that. I wasn't comfortable with unless I was to do it myself, I don't think that technology can capture the tone of what I write and how I write. You know what I mean? So there's a sort of, it doesn't reflect as well on, or doesn't capture exactly, let's say, what you wanna say. You know, people who've read a long time will know that there's a lot of nonsense and in jokes and sort of running themes that exist within the blog, right? That makes sense if you're reading it, you know, if you've read it for years, you'll go, oh yeah, there he goes again or whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, if some AI voice is talking about Phil Collins, you go, what's that about? So a long answer to your question is that, like, of course I look around, but I'm very comfortable doing what it is that I do.
Yeah. Yeah. I deleted a question about Phil Collins because I thought it would be of less value to this audience. But let's move on just to talk about some kind of more general stuff. I mean, one of the things that's significantly different, I think, across not just Arsenal, but across kind of, you know, football clubs in general, is this relationship with fan media. And it's gone from being sort of really arm's length to there being something... You know, it's not an incorporation, but it's something that's closer to the relationship that an established media brand might have with football clubs, where there has to be some kind of working relationship. You know, and in some cases with Arsenal, it might be that, you know, you have guys on tour, which you just had, you've just been in Singapore yourself, or it can be sort of more addressing the community. Mikel Arteta was at your event in Union Chapel, for example. Now, that brings with it, you know, a certain change in the relationship, because you're not kind of having conversations at a distance. And, you know, very recently you've had to have a very difficult conversation about an episode which put you guys, I think, in a really challenging position as well, around Thomas Partey, for example. But it won't always be as serious as that. There will just be kind of an expectation that you have some editorial independence. You know, how have you dealt with that development? Because it's not strictly a commercial thing. It's you know, it's just a kind of change in the waters, I guess, and a change in the way that a fan media organization is going to be viewed.
It's such an interesting one, you know, because you mention things like editorial independence, and those to me, that's very, very important. Like, there is benefit to me and to the audience if I have a relationship with, let's say, the Arsenal communications team. Because information is good, right? And it's not a case that, you know, anyone at Arsenal has ever said to me, listen, this is what we want you to write. This is what this story is. This is what that is. It doesn't work that way. But you can have conversations with people, and you can talk to people about things that happen at the club or in football, and it gives you, let's say, a wider perspective on those things. Therefore, when you collect your own thoughts and you write about them, or you think or you talk about them on the podcast, you've got more information. You also have to understand, why am I getting this information, or why is that? So listen, I'm old enough and wise enough, and I've been around the block enough times to not be in any way, I would say, and again, this makes it sound like Arsenal would do this, compromise. That's not the way that they operate. You know, they don't sort of just randomly text you out of the blue and say, this is, you know, most of the time you hear something and you text them and you say, is there anything in this or is there anything in that? I mean, I spoke to people and talked to people out there in Singapore, and they know who we are and we know who they are. And it's all very amicable, and you know, I'm comfortable with the relationship that I have. Again, I'm not a journalist, you know. I'm sort of just a random guy with a blog with opinions. Whereas, for example, you know, James was out in Singapore, and quite a number of what you would call sort of regular media were out there. So it was in their interests to go to a meeting or to go and, you know, have a bit of time with people at the club, senior people at the club, because that's their job. But for me, it wasn't. I didn't need to do that. And I didn't need to go there. And that's also fine, you know? I think, you know, there's always going to be people who think, people have a funny idea of how they think the media works, particularly around football, you know? Like I said, there's this idea, there's a sort of nefarious mechanism behind the way Arsenal operate or any football club operates. You know, I think any football club in this day and age recognize that they're not just a football club. They're a business. They're a large organization. They have to protect themselves, not just in terrible things, but like generally speaking. But the idea that, for example, you know, you get these, you know, have a bad result and the next day there's a kit launch. And people are, you know, a new piece of merchandise and people go, look, typical, you know, we lost a game and to take everyone's mind off it, they're launching a new set of Adidas retro merchandise.
Yeah.
You can't just sort of go 4 o'clock on a Sunday. Uh-oh, we've lost. Get a new whole kit out, you know, so that there is this idea, I think, to in some corners that the media, are complicit in those kinds of things, whereas it's just not really the case, you know?
Yeah, very possible that people would have bought more merch if on the back of a win.
Yeah.
But that again, does it come back to community? I mean, I've listened to you guys for years and read the blog longer than I care to remember. And the conversation that you had around that party episode, I think you spoke for a lot of people, you know, who'd been frustrated at how it had been handled. And I don't want to go into it too much here because it's still a very complex thing to talk about publicly. Mm. But, you know, does having that kind of sense of your communities, does that help you work through how you're going to address issues around the club, whether that's sporting or non-sporting ones?
I think I trust in the community to understand that when I talk about something or say something, whether it's about football or whether it's about life or whether it's about anything, that it's my honestly held opinion. And that's kind mm-hmm. of been where I've always said to people, you know, going back to the advice people would say, you know, what should I do if I start a blog? And my advice was always be honest about what you think. Don't write what you think people want you to write, or don't write things which you know are going to garner attention, but aren't your honest opinion, because ultimately that will come back to bite you. Mm. It'll come back to bite you. Over the course of 20 odd years of doing the website, have I been wrong about things? Absolutely. Of course. 100%. You get something wrong, or your opinion is, you know, shifts over time, or you look back on things and you go, maybe I could have done that a bit differently. But at the time, you can stand over it and say, listen, that was just how I felt at that time. Yeah. That was what I thought about that. So it's not that I don't consider the community. Of course I do. You know, you have to, but you don't let the community drive what it is that you think.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Because, you know, yeah, like I said, I think people, whether they agree with me or disagree with me, and people disagree with me a lot, not sure they're necessarily part of the community per se, but not everybody who's part of the community agrees with everything I write.
Yeah.
You know, that one story you're talking about there in particular, you know, has been contentious. It has been very difficult. You know, we have people who see one side of it. We have people who see, you know, a completely different side of it. We also have very many, women as part of our community, and that's important, particularly around the coverage of Arsenal women that we provide. So there is that consideration when you're thinking about those kinds of things. But like I said, it's just about being honest. You can be right, you can be wrong, but if you're honest, I think it's not that you get a free pass, but you can stand over what you think. And if in time your opinion changes because of more information or evidence or whatever it might be, I think you're in a position to be able to do that. You can say, well, listen, back then we didn't know that. Now we know this. Now this is my opinion.
Yeah.
And I feel, unfortunately, I feel like we live in a time where people aren't willing to change their opinion on things, even with more information and more evidence. And there's a tendency to double down, you know, whereas you could, mea culpa, you know,
Yeah.
There's a lot to be said for that. And I think that, you know, unfortunately is in a bit of short supply, not just in football or just in the media, but generally.
Yeah. What do you think, just taking a bit of a step back, the challenge that fan media has created, or the change, I guess, that it's stimulated in football media more generally? I mean, you are a consumer of general football media, albeit I get the impression less and less over time. But, you know, what have you made of that dynamic? There's definitely been a response, and in some cases in terms of incorporation of voices, but in some cases in terms of the sort of the character of certain general football coverage. But there's always going to be parts that it can't reach, just
of course
scale.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's been so interesting, you know, over the course of Arsblog and the last 20 odd years and the development of fan media in general, is that I think there were certain voices of authority, right, within football media, football writing, very, very good journalists, really good journalists, really good writers, who were, in the absence of anything different, the voices of authority when they wrote about football. So when they wrote about Liverpool, when they wrote about Arsenal, when they wrote about Man United, when they wrote about Chelsea, or when they wrote about any club, there was a sense that this guy really knows what he's talking about. Over time, fan media outlets are able to produce content that is far more detailed, far more granular than anything any of those journalists could possibly do. And that's not criticism of them, because how could they? How could, you know, a Henry Winter know as much about any football club or every football club as one particular fan or one particular fan media outlet can, right? It's not to say he's ignorant or unaware or anything like that, but there is such focus on every aspect of a football club. You know, again, this isn't just relevant to Arsblog, mm-hmm. It's relevant to all football fan media. If you're covering the nuts and bolts, you know, you're down in the basement of what your football club does, you know, from top to bottom, you're covering it, then you probably have a much greater understanding and a greater knowledge of what has happened and will happen has happened at that football club than a guy who has to write about the England international team. He has to write about women's football. He has to write about all the teams. Like, you know, I'm not saying their knowledge is surface level, but it doesn't quite go as deep, you know? So I think that the impact of that, for better or worse, is that some of the authority is taken away from those writers and those journalists, because people will say, well, you don't know, back in 2017, Matthew Flamini had a conversation with Mesut Ozil and blah, 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 blah. And people remember this mad stuff, and, you know, it might not be relevant to anything. I think sometimes it goes a little bit too far. Sometimes, you know, people view sort of traditional journalism now as almost an attack on their club. They see the lack of depth of knowledge as a kind of fundamental ignorance, mm-hmm. which I don't think is the case. I really don't. You know, there's lots of great football writers out there and lots of good journalists doing amazing work. But the audience wants something different now these days. Your surface level guy who goes to the match at the weekend is happy to read the back pages, and that's as much football content as he wants. Nothing's changed.
Mm.
But if you want to get up in the morning and read about your football club and talk about your football club from morning to night, you can do that. And with that brings a sort of, it's a very different dynamic, you know?
Yeah.
The people are absolutely wedded to the content from first thing in the morning to last thing at night. You know, whether it's videos or podcasts or writing or blogs or news or comments or whatever it is, it's very different. There is no off switch anymore.
Mm.
You know, things resonate for much longer than they did or they used to. You know, conversations, you know, about a game before the internet, people would go to the pub afterwards, have a few pints, talk about the game, and then that's kind of it until next week, until the next game. Till you meet your mates to go to the next match. Whereas now everything resonates for a long, long time and nobody forgets.
Yeah.
Nobody forgets any kind of mistake or any kind of, you know, someone writes something and it's not quite right. You know, they're torn a new one. I don't know. It's curious. It's just different.
Yeah. I mean, what would you want to see from those more established, all those more general interest platforms in that context? Or is that not really something you think about or see as your place?
Not really my place. I mean, the newspaper industry that's a whole different conversation, isn't it? You know, that is a different conversation. Again, I think once people are operating in good faith, then, you know, that's kind of as much as you want from football media. I think sometimes I do feel, not necessarily with written work, because, you know, I'm not going to read too much tabloidy stuff, and you read sort of the, in inverted commas, the broadsheets sometimes. I think where we've really seen it have an effect is on TV coverage, where social media, where algorithms and clipping up Roy Keane shouting at Jamie Carragher for 2 minutes is great values. It generates a lot of eyeballs. It generates a lot of clicks. It probably generates a lot of revenue. What value do we get out of that beyond like watching two drunk guys try and fight each other in a car park? Does it add to our level of football analysis? Does it add to our knowledge and understanding of the game? I'm not sure. Like, they do good stuff. There is good stuff on these channels, on these platforms, but I feel increasingly like the only thing we're seeing is the stuff that gets memed and, you know, TikToked and Instagrammed and whatever way you want to put it, you know? Yeah. It feels more like football is an entertainment medium than a sporting medium. And that may well be a consequence of the money that's in the game now and the way the game has gone over the last number of years and the investments and, you know, what it costs to buy a player and what it costs to pay a player. You know, Sky have to pay a fortune for the rights to show these games. Do they have to prioritize the things that generate the most opportunity for them to get new subscribers? Maybe they do. Yeah. But then that's where I think there's a place for what we do and for what many of the fan media outlets do, which is provide more thoughtful, considered content on the game, the games, the clubs, the players, the performances, those kinds of things.
Yeah. One more thing, and then we'll just move on to our quick battery of questions that we ask all of our guests. But, you know, you talk about the influence you've had in that respect, or the function you serve in that respect. One of the things that I feel like fan media has changed is the understanding of who or what a fan of a football club can be. Because if I think of around the time you started, we were still kind of it was maybe a bit of the long tail, but the idea that there was a distinction between the armchair fan and the match-going fan. And now it feels like fandom can be one of 100 different things. You know, you're a lifelong Arsenal fan, but you're based in Dublin, and you started when you were writing in Barcelona, and you've got colleagues who are based in the US, and you go to Singapore and you have, you know, meetups with readers, never mind Arsenal fans, in that part of the world. I mean, how do you reflect on how this phenomenon has shifted perspectives on what fandom is and what it can be?
I think it's amazing, to be honest, because wherever you are in the world, if you're a fan of a football club, you want to connect with that club and you want to feel like you're part of it to some extent, right? And ultimately, there is a difference between the match-going fan and, for want of a better expression, the armchair fan. The vast majority of Arsenal fans or Man United fans or Liverpool fans are armchair fans. There's only 50, 60, 70,000 people can go to a game at the Emirates or Old Trafford or Anfield, yet there are millions, tens of millions around the world who are watching. So the experience is different, of course. I think the perspective is different as well. If you're going to a game every week and you're paying your season ticket, your perspective is different simply because your experience is different, right? You know, you can go to a game, and it's happened to me, you know. I go to games, obviously. I'll go to a game and I'll come out of it and I'll think, let's say I've got one big hot take from the game, whatever it might be, whether it's a player or an incident or whatever. And you come out and you go on the internet and you realize that everybody is talking about something else completely, something that you haven't seen or something you haven't experienced within the game. It might be because it's something that they do on commentary. They talk about it on commentary. They repeat it over and over and over. And you know how that happens. Like a narrative can build from the commentary, whether it's the commentator, whether it's Gary Neville going on and on about something. And then everybody starts thinking about that something and it becomes sort of confirmation bias to an extent, right? So that experience is very different. But I think what there has been over the last 20 odd years is an understanding that if you're a fan of a football club, it doesn't really matter where in the world you are. You know, if you love the club, if you love the players, if you love the team, it's hard sometimes to reconcile the idea that like people love the club and love the team and love the players by virtue of what they say online. You get the idea that they hate everything about it, some of them, but that's just how they experience it. But, you know, I've always been of the opinion that like, I'm an Irish guy who started a website in Spain about a team in London, and can I consider myself any better than any other fan anywhere around the world? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And it's been part of what we've done, you know, is to try and make it as inclusive as possible, make the community as inclusive as possible for people who will never get to London, who will never, ever get to see Arsenal play at the Emirates Stadium or anywhere else, to feel like they can be part of something, whether it's just on a match day or whether it's, you know, reading the player ratings or the match report or whatever it might be, or the blog the day after. Football is global now. There's no putting the genie back in the bottle, you know. Football clubs understand that now because of the way they operate, you know, the tours that they go on, whether it's Singapore, Hong Kong, the United States, Australia, China. You know, clubs are looking to maximize their fan bases worldwide for all the reasons that we understand. But part of that as well is making those fans feel like they're genuinely part of something. And I think that's, you know, that's really important. I think it can only be a good thing for me.
Okay. Well, I think you've done a fine job of that over the last 20 odd years, but let's come to the close here. We've got three questions that we've been asking everybody. The first is, do you have an origin story of your own or something that sparked your interest in sport?
Just as a kid, I loved football. I loved playing football. I grew up in I grew up in a castle.
Okay.
It was a hotel. My dad was the manager of the hotel, and it had a big gardens in the front, a big front lawn. And myself and my little brother, who's about 3 years younger than me, would play football on that every day. Every day we could get out there, we'd just play football. And I think that was ultimately what sparked my love of football, of the game, of playing it, of being fortunate enough for it to be my working life now, you know, which even when I started RSBlog was completely unthinkable. Hmm. But I just think from a very early age, kicking a football around with my dad, with my brother, that was it.
Yeah. Where did the Arsenal connection come from, incidentally? I guess you would have been in the just post-Brady.
Well, no, this was, yeah. I was born in Croydon.
Okay, right.
In 1971. And then we lived in this castle in Yorkshire, this hotel in Yorkshire, just outside Hull, actually, Humberside. But at that time, Arsenal had Liam Brady, Frank Stapleton, David O'Leary, John Devine, Pat Rice, Sammy Nelson, Pat Jennings, mm-hmm. all these Irishmen. I didn't really know the difference between Ireland and Northern Ireland at that time. But, you know, my parents were Irish, like many people moved to the UK in the 50s and 60s. But we were always told you're Irish, you know, there was no getting away from the Irish roots. So I think the Arsenal connection was simply that as somebody, you know, as a kid who loved football, reading Roy of the Rovers, reading Shoot magazine, whatever it was, the team that had the most Irish players at that time was Arsenal.
Yeah.
In Ireland, it's Liverpool, Man United are basically one and two for pretty obvious reasons. Mm. You know, the Irish communities in both of those cities, some Irish players down the years. But Arsenal, probably third. And that's what it was. There was lots of Irish players at Arsenal. I don't remember ever making a conscious choice like, I am going to support Arsenal. My brother ended up supporting Liverpool. I put it down to the fact he's basically a glory hunter because they were just winning everything back then. I've always been for the underdog a little bit, you know?
Yeah. I was just trying to match the timelines up because, there was that run of Arsenal players from the Republic Fund that went kind of well into the late 80s with kind of O'Leary and Quinn and stuff. But we're getting down a rabbit hole here and we've already used up a lot of everybody's time. What's your favourite piece of sports storytelling?
My favourite piece of sports storytelling? That is a great question. There's a book called, a book by Joe McGinnis called The Miracle of Castel di Sangro. It's about this Italian football club, and this guy's an American writer, an American journalist who happens to be there, and he writes this book about this football club, and it's a crazy story. Italian football, match fixing, possible connections to, you know, some Italian people who, you know, you do what they say, and coupled with this sort of incredible enthusiasm, but also naivety from the writer, makes it just a really, really compelling piece of literature. So I'd really recommend that to everybody.
Okay. And finally, what's a sports story you'd like to tell or you'd like to see somebody else tell?
I'd like to tell the story of how Arsenal won the league again after 20 years. Honestly, it's sort of there in black and white for 20 odd years. You know, on the blog, we've come close. We've had some good times, some bad times, some really bad times. But those season after season is chronicled in the blog, you know, on a daily basis. You know, I write about what happens. So for me, after so long and wanting Arsenal to succeed and wanting Arsenal to be champions again, and having done this as my work for such a long time, I feel like it's something I'd really like to share with the people who read the blog and listen to the podcast, and to experience that with them, and to sort of, I feel like there would be a sort of massive outpouring of joy / relief.
Sure.
And to be sort of able to contextualize that for people in words, whether they're written or on the podcast, that is something I would really like.
Yeah. Well, I would appreciate that. I think there will be listeners who maybe wouldn't, but can't please everyone. Andrew, thanks very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, and thank you very much indeed.
Outlines is an original production from 2640.